There is a brand new book that just came out, which was a long time in coming, but it's a fabulous read. Frank Lorenzo has written a new book called Flying for Peanuts. It's tough deals, steep bargains, and revolution in the skies. And Frank Lorenzo had revolution in the skies. He took little tiny, what used to be known as Trans-Texas and Texas International Airlines, and merged it into and created through Texas Air one of the largest airline holding companies in the free world. Continental Airlines, Eastern Airlines, People Express, Frontier. And, of course, he started New York Air. Frank Lorenzo joins us right now. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you. Thank you, David. Nice to be here.
That was, I mean, just absolutely remarkable accomplishments. But I think the one thing I want to ask is there's something about this industry and the people that are the high profile people that it either attracts or makes. I mean, Howard Hughes, Juan Trippe, Herb Kelleher, Richard Branson, Bob Six and Bob Crandall and Frank Lorenzo, all sort of bigger than life. What is it about the airline industry that attracts all this? Because it's not a great way to make money usually.
No, they you know, the old trope that if you want to be a millionaire, start with a billion and buy an airline. Airlines are tough, are tough economically. But you know what happens, David, it seems to me, is that you develop a passion for airlines. And Howard Hughes is a good example. When I was growing up, he was a great symbol. We had great respect for him. And what he did, what he accomplished, and what his goals were. The fact of the matter is that in my case, it was a passion that developed at a young age. I can still remember standing in our yard, in a little house that my parents had in Rego Park, Queens, not far from the glide path going into LaGuardia Airport, and we'd watch these airplanes coming in, and I would always be looking up, looking forward to the day when I might be on an airplane. And that day came when I was 15, when my parents decided to go to Europe to see my brother, who was stationed in the army in Idar-Oberstein in Germany.
Were you on one of those super constellations from Howard Hughes?
No, in those days it wasn't the Super Constellation. It was the plain ordinary 049. I was on the Super G Constellation in later years, but in those years it was the 049 or 749 Constellation, and the flight was initially out of LaGuardia Airport, which had international flights in those days.
With sometimes some stops along the way, you know. But the
yes, no, for sure. We stopped in Newfoundland because the airplane did not have the capacity to go nonstop to London.
Well, pleasure. At least you can get off and stretch your legs for a while too. But
sure.
those days in the airlines, people don't understand pre deregulation. I mean, it was a vastly different business. I mean, it was the government controlled everything, and they told him what they could charge, and everybody seemed to make a profit, and they subsidized you with mail business or something like that. But it was really expensive to fly.
It was, and the government controlled everything. I can remember one time flying on Eastern Airlines, and I was treated to a first class seat. This is 1977, and I'm in first class, and all of a sudden I see a guy light up a cigar in the first class cabin, and the whole plane just fills up with the cigar smoke. I said to myself, this is crazy. So when I came back to Houston, I said to our troops, I said, let's do something about this. Let's file with the CAB to take off cigars and pipes. We were trying to really establish ourselves as a consumer-friendly company, so this was right up our alley. But we were the first to apply, and you had to get approval to do something like take cigars and pipes smoking off the airplane. But that was regulation in those days.
Deregulation came along, and the idea was that there'd be more entrants, there'd be more competition, it would drive prices lower, and indeed it did a lot of that, but it also pretty well bankrupted all of the old and established carriers who were playing by the old rules.
Well, it wasn't so much that they were playing by the old rules, it's that they were handcuffed by the by their union contracts. The Congress deregulated the revenue side, but it never did anything about the cost side. It left it up to the carriers. And the carriers were not able to, in many cases, get through to the unions and for them to understand that deregulation meant new entry. It meant pilots, for example, coming in at half the cost that a United or a Delta would pay. And sooner or later, it would catch up with them. And of course, sooner or later, it did. In our case, we didn't have a big hub like Chicago or a big hub like San Francisco to tide us over. We had Southwest Airlines in our backyard where they were really making us eat our lunch because we had old labor contracts, which is itself another story. But it's well told in my book.
Well, but you were flying and you started the peanut fairs at Texas International, hence the title of your book, Flying for Peanuts. But that was the competition. You had to slash fares. I mean, to the point where were you subsidizing people to fly? Could you make money at those fares?
Well, yes, we did. We made a lot of money and it really put us on the map because we were the first carrier to apply to the CAB. Albeit as an experiment, because this was before the regulation was approved by the Congress, the first one to apply for an experiment to see whether more people would fly if you cut fares. And we took select markets and select flights and had no restrictions, and they were generally half fare. So those flights were full. But not only that, but it generated interest in the whole airline, and the whole airline did very well.
You were getting people off the couch that otherwise wouldn't have flown.
That's right, exactly. Even if they had to buy a full fare one way and a half fare another way, they really liked the concept, and it brought low fares. And then through the 80s, we followed it up with various other things at Continental Airlines as well. But we were the first to be out there with a unrestricted low fare. And we did it even before it was approved to be legal by the Congress.
Because you got the exception to do it. Let me leap forward a little bit in time to a time that I really want to talk to you about, is you ended up with the Eastern Shuttle, which would just seem like, you know, just a cash cow. People going back and forth from New York to Washington, D.C. You just get out there, don't even plan ahead. You walk on an airplane, and you know, an hour later you're in Washington, D.C. and back and forth. But you ended up selling it, and you sold it to an unlikely buyer, I would have thought.
Well, you're thinking of the Eastern Shuttle in the 70s and early 80s. But when we started New York Air and brought New York Air into the market in direct competition with Eastern, things started changing. And Eastern's traffic was dropping when we had our shuttle. The fact is that as we got into the late 80s, it was no longer a cash cow. In fact, when we evaluated it, it looked like the traffic was going down repeatedly, because in order to buy our interest in Eastern, which I never ran, but nevertheless, in order for us to buy our interest, we had to give up New York Air. And in doing that, we sold it to Pan Am, and Pan Am became a tough competitor then for Eastern. So by the time we got to sell it, it was a great property, a great name, great reputation, and you could really do something with it. And former President Trump really thought that he had an opportunity. We thought it was a very legitimate thing to buy, and we had a valuation of $425 million. He first told us he wanted to pay $250 million for it, but we went to a long dance, and we finally arrived at $365 million through compromise.
And he turned it into, well, one of the things he did, he changed the livery and put this fairly sort of inconspicuous paint scheme, as I remember, on the airplanes.
Well, it was Trump Airlines, so it was, you know, or Trump Shuttle. I forget what he put on it. And he did a lot to the airplanes. He put new bathrooms in. You know, he really made the inside of it to be relatively elegant. But then, and he closed that deal in June of 1989. And then a year later, you had the Kuwaiti invasion, and fuel prices went crazy, and they affected all airlines, including the now Trump shuttle. And he ran into difficulties. But in addition to that, he was having trouble with some of his hotel properties, which also suffered after the Kuwaiti invasion. And he defaulted on some loans in September of 1990.
It is a cyclical business. I guess it just, you get kerosene in your veins or something instead of blood, and it attracts it. Just fascinating. And there's a lot more to the book. Will you come back and we'll maybe leap forward and give us some insight into what's going on in the airline industry right now?
Sure.
We'll look forward to it.
Happy to do it.
Meanwhile, grab a copy of Flying for Peanuts, Tough Deals, Steep Bargains, and Revolution of the Skies by Frank Lorenzo. It'll bring back, as it did for me, some fascinating memories. For more of our conversation, go to krld.com/CEO. I'm David Johnson, News Radio 1080 KRLD.